You are listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprungs disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprungs with a positive message throughout.
Hello and welcome to episode 130 of Tom's Hirschsprungs podcast. I'm delighted this afternoon to be joined by Andrea. Andrea, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No, thank you so much for coming on. Now, we're here to talk about your child with Hirschsprungs and of a total colonic Hirschsprungs as well, which obviously is incredibly rare. So to have a very rare condition and then have another very rare diagnosis on top, obviously incredibly rare story. But I guess if you could take us back, well, start from wherever you like.
Yeah, so he is 3 years old right now, so I will do my best to rewind and start from the very beginning. So I had a very easy, normal pregnancy. I'm one of those rare ones that loves being pregnant. I had no issues whatsoever. And my water broke naturally, and I headed to the hospital, and I was doctoring about 2 hours from my house. So I'm driving over there, and everything's fine. We get there, and everything happens really fast. I'm, you know, dilating fast, and I start pushing way too early. And he actually gets stuck in my birth canal, and they had to use forceps to get him out. So I'm telling you this because it's his diagnosis wasn't caught right away, and I feel like it's because of this trauma. So they kept me and him there a couple days extra just for some observation, and he wasn't eating right off the bat. And so they kind of chalked it up to, you know, like, he's had some birth trauma. He's probably got a sore neck, you know, like, isn't comfortable. So they just dismissed that, and they just encouraged me to pump so that my milk would come in and then keep trying every couple hours. And I think he ate one time total, and we still kept having issues. And so they thought maybe he had a tongue tie, and he actually did. So they went and clipped his tongue to get rid of that, and that didn't change anything. So we kept trying and trying. I had worked with different lactation consultants, and a couple of days go by, it's day 3, and he hasn't pooped yet. He hasn't passed the newborn meconium. And so they're like, well, that's kind of strange. You know, we'll give him a suppository, and then when he poops, you can go home. And I was like, okay, well, sure. Like, this is my first baby. This is my first pregnancy. Never been a mom. I didn't know what is normal, what is not normal. You know, like, this stuff is not in the baby books. So I think you also naturally trust your care team. Like, I'm not going to question anything that they're doing. So they give him a suppository. He smears a little bit, and then they're like, okay, well, he pooped. You can go home. Everything's great. And I think we were home for 5 days, and I had another appointment with a lactation consultant to try to get him breastfeeding. And during that appointment, we're talking about how he's still not eating. He's maybe taking, I think it was like 15 milliliters at a time, like just a tiny, tiny amount. And I mentioned, like, and he's still not pooping. And she's like, oh, well, that's normal. You know, breastfed babies don't poop every day. And I was like, yeah, but he's like not pooping. And she called up my doctor to see if he was available. And he's like, give it 2 more days. And if not, like, we'll give him another suppository. And so I we do that. And then I give him the suppository and he actually like poops so much. It like shoots across my living room. Like it's like on a massive, massive amount. So obviously he feels great now. So he starts eating a little bit more. I think he got up to maybe 20 milliliters. And so it's still not a lot. I'm using like the tiny, tiny baby bottles from hospital. And I took him to the chiropractor a couple times because I've heard that that can help. You know, getting adjusted can help digestive issues. And he did confirm that he had some neck trauma. So we worked through that and things got better. He never breastfed yet, but he was feeling better, you could tell. And then another 5-6 days go by and he doesn't poop. And so I call up his doctor and I mention that. And I said, should I give him another suppository? And he's like, well, no, we don't want him to get dependent on that. Like he needs to learn to use his muscles, and kind of made it sound like it was him holding his poop in, like not using his muscles. And I thought that was interesting because I'm like, don't babies just know how to poop? Right. So I ended up getting kind of frustrated with that doctor. So I switched doctors and I took him to, I think he was 20 days old, and I took him to a new doctor. And I said, this is what's happening. This is what's going on. Like, I just feel in my gut that something's not right. And she's like, okay, well, how about we take some x-rays? And like, if that makes you comfortable, like if that'll make you feel better. And I said, yes, please. And she gives me a call the next day when they get reviewed and there's nothing showing any kind of blockage. There's nothing that is concerning whatsoever. So I'm like, okay, it's just me. Like I'm overreacting. I'm a new mom. You know, I'm whatever. And she also said, gave me the line, breastfed babies don't poop every day. Like, it's totally normal. Like, don't freak out. So I started keeping a diary of how many days he was going without pooping and how much he was eating and all of this. Cause I'm just like, something's not normal about this. Like, I can't put my finger on it. And then day 26, he's 26 days old and he starts vomiting. And it's like, so much vomit, like projectile vomiting after every time I try to feed him. And I freaked out. I'm like, I told my husband we should take him to the ER. And me and my husband are very, you know, I have enough nurse friends to know what constitutes an ER visit. You know, like your arm should be falling off. So we're just like, okay, we're just going to wait this out, see how it goes. You know, it's probably not an emergency. You know, maybe it's something I ate because he is drinking my breast milk, you know. So we waited out and he's like, if he's still puking in the morning, make an appointment. So I did because he puked all night. And then as I'm buckling him into the car seat to bring him to this appointment, his vomit turned bright green. And I instantly started panicking because I've never seen that before. I'm like, something's not right. And so I rush him over there. They take more x-rays. They can't find anything. And he's vomiting this green stuff the entire time. And she's like, okay, so where I should really stop and say where I live is like the middle of nowhere. So like population 100 people. And so the nearest hospital is 20 minutes away, but they're very rural healthcare. So she, bless her soul, was honest enough, sat me down and said, you know, I don't know what's going on. And I don't have, she's like, I just don't have the knowledge to figure this out. I'm going to give Children's Hospital in Sioux Falls a call and just see what they recommend. And I said, great, sounds good. And she calls them and she sends over the x-rays and they're like, we need him on a helicopter ASAP. And she comes back, she tells me that. And I'm just, I'm a mess because I'm like, what do you mean? Like, is my baby okay? Like, excuse me. I did bring my Kleenexes. I kind of figured this was going to happen. So, and mind you, I'm 4 weeks postpartum. So, like, I'm just a wreck in the first place. And my baby is supposed to go on a helicopter. And I don't know why. Like, nobody can tell me what's wrong with him. So, I'm just a mess. And so, this was several, I mean, it was 10 o'clock when I brought him there, and the helicopter finally came at 2. So this was a while, and I'm breastfeeding, so I don't have anything with me. So I choose to not get on the helicopter with my baby and go home and pack a bag so that I can pump and head to the hospital. And that was really hard, too, because I wanted to be with my baby. And then I call up my husband and I tell him what's going on. And he's at work hours away. So he leaves work, starts heading home so he can pack. And we drive separate. And I get to the hospital. And I think on the helicopter, they tried, and I'm not going to know the specific name, but they tried to release air out of his digestive system. They put a tubing down him and nothing came up. So they took it out. And then I get to the hospital and he's just there in a room by himself. And, you know, like there's nothing happening. Well, they had already did the ultrasound. They had already did more x-rays. And at this point, they think it's pyloric stenosis, which I believe is the valve between your esophagus or your intestine and your stomach. Sometimes it needs to be repaired. And so they did the ultrasound and it ruled out that it wasn't that stenosis. So they didn't know what was really happening. So they were just kind of observing him at this point. And then his vomits. So he's still vomiting. And mind you, he hasn't eaten in 2 days. So I think that says a lot. And then his vomits had stopped from bright green and they had turned to this orange, like foul smell. Like it smelled like stool. It was the most rancid smell. I will never forget that smell. And I'm putting the call light on every time this happens because I'm just losing it. I'm like, what is happening to my baby? Like there's something wrong. And every nurse is just, okay, well, we'll document it. And I'm just getting so frustrated. And all of a sudden, this nurse walks by. And I refer to my son as my miracle baby because these miracles just kept happening. And this was the first miracle. So this nurse walks by. And she's not even my nurse. She's not on my wing. She's not taking care of my son. She just happens to walk by. And she goes, I recognize that smell. I know that smell. You need to speak to a GI surgeon immediately. And she runs to go get a surgeon. And they're like, okay, I'm pretty sure this is Hirschsprung's. Like, we need to do a biopsy and test for that. And we're going to order, you know, an upper GI study and a contrast enema. And I said, okay, so we do all of that. And so I believe, so it was actually this time, 3 years ago, which is kind of crazy now that I think about it. It was Memorial Day weekend. And he's like, the biopsy results usually take 3 to 5 days. But because it's a holiday, it's going to take even longer. And I said, great. So they teach me how to do irrigations. And so we start doing those, I think, like every 4 to 6 hours. And then it relieved a lot of stool. So he actually started eating again, which is really great. And so they do the biopsy, they do the contrast enema, they don't see anything with that. And then the biopsy comes back positive. So the biopsy tests for ganglion cells being present. And that's what is the nerve cells in your colon that pushes the stool along. So it tested positive that he didn't have those. So he technically had Hirschsprung's. So, but because of his condition and because of how weak he was, they weren't comfortable doing surgery that day. They were actually planning on sending us home for 2 weeks and doing the irrigations and sending us back to do what's called a pull-through procedure. And then everything went south. He stopped eating again and the irrigation stopped working. Nothing was coming out. And they just had made the decision, okay, he needs this surgery now. And so we go to the surgery tower at Sanford. Everything's in different buildings. So this was interesting to me. I've never had a surgery ever in my life, but I went to the surgery tower and they have what's like a giant family common area. So what was weird for me is that I'm an empath, so I pick up on everyone's energy. And it's just like people over to your left are, you know, with planned family members and they're having coffee and they're having cookies and everything's great. Like they're here because they're getting their rotator cuff repaired and they've had this surgery on the books for, you know, 18 months and they're just ready to get it done. And then there's people over here crying because they're waiting for their grandpa who's having emergency surgery. And it's just, I just thought it was the weirdest, most uncomfortable room to ever be in because it's
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
The station that makes you feel good.
Anyway,
yeah.
So we sit down and we're in the waiting room and they're like, well, here's some coffee, here's some cookies. And then I have to laugh because I'm like, I don't even know if my son's okay. Like, I don't really care about a cookie. but so they have this at Sanford, they have this text messaging that updates you about the surgery. So we sign up for that and I get my first text message. He's out, anesthesia. He's under, everything looks good. Surgery is about to begin. And then they say, you'll get a text update every hour. So the first hour goes by, I get an update and it said, yep, surgery is going well. Everything looks going as expected. It was just very generic. And then the next hour goes by and I don't get an update. And he had originally told me it might take 3 to 4 hours. So I didn't freak out. And then the fourth hour goes by and there's no update. And I start freaking out a little bit. And then the nurse calls us and says, Dr. Keckler and his team want to speak with you guys. And I'm like in shambles because I just have no idea what's happening. And they sit us down. So it's Dr. Keckler and Dr. Gora, who I am so grateful to God that they are our care team because they're incredible. They sit us down and they're like, hey, we were, you know, about halfway through the surgery. And so when they went into the surgery, their job is to determine how much of the colon does not have those ganglion cells. So they're testing every few centimeters to see what part of the colon still works, what part of the colon needs or doesn't work. So they know where to reconnect everything. And he stops and he's like, I have no idea how your son made it this long.
Wow.
And he goes, it is a miracle that he is alive. And he goes, we have tested every part of his large intestine and there is no ganglion cells present. And he said, we are halfway through the small intestine and there are no ganglion cells present. So he's like, we have to, at this point, he needs a colostomy and an ileostomy. And so they were kind enough to pull us aside and just give us an update because he said it's going to be another hour or so while we perform this part of the surgery. And I said, okay, thank you for letting us know. And we leave and I am just a mess. Like I remember calling my mom and just crying and crying. It was really hard. And I'm just thinking in my brain this whole time, like just kind of angry, you know, that nobody listened to me.
Yeah, I guess that's going to be the most frustrating part of all.
So, he comes out of surgery and we go to see him and it's horrible. He's gray colored and he's weak and he just doesn't look like my baby. And I think the next day it was the same day, it was like a couple hours later, I get a new nurse who is she's a doctor on our surgical care team, but she's called the stoma nurse. So she comes in and she gives me an hour-long lesson on being a stoma nurse and what a stoma is and how to change the bags and how to empty them and lessons on skincare. And I just remember, like, at one point, I'm like, I haven't even processed my son getting on the helicopter yet. And it's just been, you know, one thing after another, like irrigations, surgery, stomas. And it was just a lot. And I say that, I want to mention that because there is so much trauma that happens to us parents. To my son, yes, of course, but to also us as caretakers and parents and a mother. And so I'm just, at this point, I'm just going through the motions, and I have to add too. So like I'm sitting there during my son's 6-hour surgery and I'm stepping away every 2 hours to go pump. So I'm walking back across the street to his room and it's just, it's so much. And I remember thinking at one point, like, why am I doing this? Like, I should, you know, I shouldn't be doing this because it's so much added emotionally and so much physically after what I'm going through. Like, I didn't even need to, I should have just got on that helicopter and stopped, you know? And I learned later that he wouldn't be able to tolerate formula. So I was grateful that I continued breastfeeding because my breast milk was the best thing for him. So I'm glad that I pushed through that. But to rewind a little bit, in the hospital, I'm going through all this and I'm just kind of, I'm in robot mode, you know, I'm just kind of going through the motions because I haven't really processed any of this. And so we spent a few, I think, more days there. We were there start to finish 15 days. So we go home and we start caring for our new, or start our new chapter or whatever. And the way that I understood it was if I lived in Sioux Falls, I would have a stoma nurse come out to my house and care, help me with my son. And because I lived where I lived, that wasn't an option. So that is why she had to teach me all the ins and outs. And I'm glad that I did. And it wasn't very hard for me because I had, in high school, I was a CNA. So I had seen colostomy bags before. I had already knew what to do with them. So that wasn't too big of a challenge. But learning all of the stuff for a baby and going through, you know, the insurance struggles were a nightmare. I remember, so there was only two options of bags available for infants, and both of them kind of sucked. And so I remember, you know, he would have, like, if I didn't apply it exactly perfectly, or if I used too much powder or too much this, and or if he was a little bit sweaty or rolled the wrong way, like, this bag would fall off. And I remember going through, you know, 10 bags in one day sometimes. And the frustrating part was my insurance would only cover 20 in a month. And I was so upset about that. Like, there's been quite a few things on our journey, just with powders and creams and things that insurance will not cover that I just am so frustrated by. But that is probably our worst nightmare as a family, just the cost of everything and the financial pressures, like, because it's, the insurance part is just not fair at all. But so we do that. And I remember just about the time that I would get the hang of what I'm doing, he would have a growth spurt and I would need a new bag. So that was fun. And so I specifically remember, now I'm living in fight or flight mode all the time. I'm like sleeping with one eye open. I'm putting him right next to me in bed because I'm terrified he's gonna rip his bag off, or he's gonna roll onto his bag, or something's gonna happen. And so I'm with him 24/7. I remember not going out in public a lot just because it was a hassle. I remember one time we went to the county fair on a whim. So I didn't have anything with me, and it's super hot out, and he starts sweating and the bag starts falling off. And I'm like just in shambles because I just don't know. Like, it's just living with high anxiety 24/7. Like, you're just waiting for something bad to happen. And it's rough. And I just want to mention that because I've had to do so much work to get out of that and to heal from all of that. I mean, it's tough on your marriage as well. You know, I remember waking my husband up several times in the night to help me change the bag, you know, because it's a two-person job, honestly. It really is. So that was our life for 18 months. 18 months is the age that my care team wanted him to be when they performed the pull-through surgery. So, and in this span of time, I am getting married, planning a wedding, and I feel like I kind of used that as a way to kind of cope through everything. Because I, on the outside, I'm like, oh, this is so much fun. Like, I'm getting married. I'm planning a wedding. Like, everything's great. Life is fantastic. And I'm just pushing the trauma aside, you know, until I'm ready to actually deal with what I just went through, which is a lot. And so I get married, and on our honeymoon, I actually get pregnant with our daughter. So by the time surgery rounds around, I am 7 months pregnant. And so now I'm wondering, so should I do this surgery now or should we wait? Because he always said, you know, when the time comes, don't expect this to happen. You know, we can push it out until whenever you're ready. Like, we can do it when he's 5, we can do it when he's 7, you know. We just want him minimum at least 18 months because of his build, you know, how he would grow, and they would have more intestine to work with. So I made the decision to go ahead and do it now, because in my brain I thought, well, I might as well do it now, because what am I going to do with my second child later, you know? This will just be easier. And it definitely was not. So just to rewind a little bit, so in the beginning of his life, I was not able to find daycare. So my mother was watching him. And when I got pregnant with my second child, she had said, you know, I'm not really comfortable with two kids. Can you try to find daycare? And so I had found him a spot in daycare. And once I put him in daycare, he was constantly sick. Like, every week he was sick. And so when surgery time rolled around, he was sick and he had a small fever. And so I rescheduled a couple times, and then we finally set a date. We head down there. We get a hotel room because, you know, you have to be there at like 6 a.m. And we wake up and he has a fever. And they're like, we cannot move forward. Like, we're through the pre-check, we're through the meet with anesthesia, we're through everything. And they took his temperature and he had a fever. And they're like, we can't perform the surgery. And I remember being so angry and looking back, selfish, because of course I'm like, we spent all this money on the hotel, we've missed work, we've done this, like, what is the big deal? And he, bless him, he cares so much to explain, like, because I guess in my head I did not connect how extreme of a surgery this was, you know, like, it is a life-changing, massive surgery on a toddler. And so he sat me down. He's like, hey, this is the problem. If we go in and we do this surgery and something goes wrong, we gauge the success of this surgery by regulating his temperature. If he goes in with a fever, we can't regulate his temperature. And we don't know if he's getting an infection. We can't we can't, you know, and he was, bless his soul, he's so good at explaining that. So I finally, it kind of hit me how massive this surgery was. So I'm like, okay, yep, let's go home and we'll reschedule. So I think we rescheduled for the next month. So we go in and everything looks good. He's ready. He has no fever. They can proceed with the surgery. And then I remember my husband and I, because the doctor had asked if one of us wanted to be there when he was put under to hold his hand. And I remember my husband was just a mess about that. So I volunteered to do that. And I mean, I need to backtrack. So when we're in the hospital, you know, the first time, like even before they're putting him on the helicopter, watching your baby, watching people put IVs into your baby is just, it's so much. And I remember four people holding down my 26-day-old baby because he's fighting so hard. And I just find that it's just really hard. So,
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
We, a couple times at the hospital, they actually asked us if they wanted us to take him to another room to put the IVs in so we wouldn't have to watch or leave the room. And I thought that was so nice because it's very traumatizing. So my husband passed and I chose to walk down and hold his hand, which was kind of, I loved it and didn't love it. It was a nice moment. But then, so we go downstairs, he goes out and they perform the surgery. So during this specific pull-through surgery, they removed the part of the intestine that did not work. And they took the remaining small intestine that did work and they stretched it. And there was a specific medical term for that, but I don't know it. And then they reconnected it to his rectum, which they also had to stretch. And they made that sound like this would give him more time to get to the bathroom, is why they were doing that. So everything went great. Before they went into the surgery, they had asked me and my husband, hey, we have this opportunity to use robotics. Are you comfortable with that? And we said, yeah, sure. Like, we'll do anything, you know, anything that will help you guys. And when he gets out of surgery, he point blank said, if we had not used robotics, this surgery would not have been successful. And so I was grateful for that. I'm very grateful for that. I am so grateful that we live in a time that that's even a thing, to have a robotic assistant in surgery. But just so I understood it, you know, he has such a tiny body and they were able to use these robot hands to keep him open so they could visually see better and do everything better. And I just thought that was so cool. And yeah, so we're grateful for that. We're grateful that we said yes and that everything worked out. And then the hard part came. So I think we're in the hospital 2 weeks, and then I kept him home from daycare another week after that. I stayed home with him while we kind of figured out our new life. So the bags were gone. So I'm taking care of those incisions because they're healing. They had sewn them shut, but they still needed to be cared for. And then they wanted to make sure that he was pooping and everything was coming out properly before we left the hospital. So he was doing that in the hospital. And essentially, because he has no large intestine, everything pretty much runs right through him. So we had to start him on Imodium to slow down his bowels, which he takes 3 times a day. And then that helps slow things down. So when it was coming right through him, it was basically like an acid. So it would really wreck his skin and it would burn his skin. And we'd had a lot of diaper rash and really horrible time with diaper changes. So we had to figure out the right dosage of that. And then about, I think it was 6 months later, because I was doing follow-ups every month, and then we went down to 3 months and then every 6 months. I was telling my care team, I said, it's just really weird. I feel like he is really good, and then he has, you know, he's good for 2 weeks, and then he has this week of like diarrhea like episode where he's not sick, but he's having a hard time. He's crying about stomach pains, and mind you, he's also a toddler, so he can't really communicate that with me. I hear a lot of gurgling in his gut, and I'm just like, I just think that there's something going on. And she goes, yep, I know exactly what you're talking about. Bless this care team. Like, they have dealt with Hirschsprung's kids a lot. They have a big caseload of them, so they know. Not every child is the same, of course, but they know enough to be able to tell me, this is what's going on. Yep, we know what to do. And so she said, yep, he needs a dose of antibiotics every 21 days, and that will clear his gut up. And she kind of explained it to me where because the large intestine is what breaks down your food, because he doesn't have that part, everything's kind of just sitting in his gut and fermenting. So that's what makes him kind of sick and lethargic and bubbly. And so the antibiotics break all that up. And I've learned now after some time that it's mostly due to his diet. So he doesn't process sugar very well. So I try to keep him sugar free. And I need to push carbs and white rice and constipating foods. He basically eats what's called like the brat diet. It's like breads, apples, pastas, bananas. And then he also has a dairy allergy. So they kind of started us off dairy free since the very beginning, because dairy and GI stuff don't really get along. But he kept having these weird reactions to to like tiny amount, like it'd be like butter in a recipe, you know. So I had him, I took him to an allergist, and it was confirmed he has a dairy allergy to the actual milk protein. So I stopped feeding him dairy, and that got a lot better. And so I need to rewind a little bit too, because I'm going from stoma mom who, when you have stomas, you have a very strict food avoidance list. So he is a baby, and I can't give him, you know, anything with seeds or anything that could potentially cause a blockage in his stoma. So he didn't eat a lot of like fresh fruits and veggies, and now he can. So I'm like, I'm transitioning to giving him, you know, fresh fruits and veggies, and he's now a toddler and he's never seen one. So he's naturally like, what is this? And doesn't want to eat it. So that is now our biggest struggle, is he's three and he has worked, you know, a good chunk of his life not eating these particular foods, and now he can eat them. And he's also, he's also used to all of these particular foods, and it's hard getting him to expand his horizons, I'll just say, because he's also three. So he's going to eat what he wants to eat. So yeah, that is where we are now.
Exactly. But no, thank you so much, because I think you've told his story absolutely brilliantly. But no, thank you so much for coming on, and I wish you, you know, all the very best for the future. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio. You can find me on Facebook under Tom's Hirschsprungs Podcast, or Instagram on Tom's_Hirschsprungs_podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll bring you another episode soon.